and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for April 15th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, budgeting for science, an ethical framework to address the complex problems of increased biofuel production and re-examining the self-steering riderless bicycle. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how distractions cause senior moments from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
A huge sigh of relief is the best way to describe what happened last week.
Science's Jeffrey Mervis reports in this week's issue on the final agreement for a 2011 spending bill in the United States and what it means for science research agencies and the science projects the U.S. contributes to around the world.
U.S. science agencies avoided what they were worried would be major cuts in their research programs after Congress and the White House reached an agreement for funding the federal government for the rest of 2011. The reason for their concern was an earlier measure that was passed by the House of Representatives that would have levied $61 billion in cuts across federal discretionary programs. That included deep cuts to several science agencies, in particular energy and climate programs, but also National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. But last week, the final agreement lets those agencies off the hook and instead imposes very small decreases in their current spending level.
You said very small decreases. How were the cuts distributed across the various science agencies?
Well, we don't know exactly how they got from the big number to the individual agencies. But as it turned out, the cuts for the major research agencies average about 1% from current spending levels. That's the case for the NIH, for NSF, for DOE Office of Science, and for the National Institute of Standards and Technology. The latter three agencies have also been promised a 10-year doubling of their budgets, a promise that goes back to the previous administration. And even though this number cuts them from 2010, the administration had emphasized the importance of supporting basic research across many fields. And so it wasn't a surprise that the administration stood up for those agencies, but it was still unexpected given the earlier actions that the House had taken.
Just to summarize, so the Bush administration, a Republican administration, had promised this 10-year doubling. Now a Democratic administration, the Obama administration, wants to keep that promise. And yet the House, which went to the Republicans to a large degree in this last election, created a budget that didn't seem to meet either's interest.
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that debates over the budget never revolve around science or research in general. The debate is about reducing federal spending. And so the new House majority, the Republican majority in the House, came in on a promise to cut $100 billion from current spending levels. Now, the math can be a little tricky, and it'll be no surprise that people use different baselines in order to support their number. But in the end, Congress and the White House agreed on a cut of $38 billion from current spending levels. Now, both sides factor in an additional $40 billion that President Obama requested in 2011. That would be the budget that was supposed to be approved last year. That was never approved. So that's an imaginary $40 billion savings, which is how you get to the larger number that the Republicans are touting, which is $78 billion. But in any event, the research agencies are a tiny percentage of discretionary domestic spending to begin with, and so no one cut could make that much of a difference. On the other hand, it's vital to keep alive research programs throughout the country.
internationally, what, if any, implications are there for scientists around the world, given this budget fight or the resolution at this point?
Well, the best news for scientists around the world is that the national laboratories run by Department of Energy are going to keep operating at near current levels. That means large user facilities like the Advanced Photon Source and the Spallation Neutron Source and other facilities are going to keep running. They're called user facilities because they host scientists from around the country and around the world. And under the House-approved cuts, a lot of those labs would have had to temporarily shutter those large facilities, at least until the end of the fiscal year in October. Now they're not going to have to do that. They're not going to lay off people either, so they'll have the technical staff to keep supporting those instruments. So that's probably the biggest impact. It also allows the U.S. to continue to meet its commitments for international projects, whether they're at the LHC or the ITER fusion reactor experiment or other bilateral agreements that agencies might have had to trim if their overall budgets were cut.
There was a lot of drama surrounding last week's budget agreement, people on both sides talking about letting the government shut down. Are there any clues based on what the different parties have said that their differing ideologies are coming closer together, or will we continue to see this kind of fight over funding?
Well, Rob, as fierce as this battle was, the debate over the 2012 budget is going to be more fierce. That's because there's more at stake. Remember, this was just to finish funding the government for the rest of the current year, and it only focused on what are called discretionary programs, meaning programs that the government has the complete flexibility to fund. It excluded entitlement programs, things like Medicare and Medicaid, and interest on the national debt that the government is required to pay. It also, by and large, excluded the Defense Department. But in 2012, all of that's going to be on the table, and one more battleground, which will be the effort to increase the borrowing ceiling that the federal government is going to bump up against in a couple of months. That's the federal debt, which is different than the annual budget deficit. So ideologically, Republicans and Democrats, Congress and the White House are even further apart on how the country should solve those problems. Science is going to go along for the ride. The community is hoping that the White House continues to insist that innovation and research are necessary in order to get out of the recession and build a stronger economy. Republicans, by and large, will argue that the deficit is dragging down economic recovery and that science has to take its fair share of the cuts in order for the government to become more fiscally responsible and for the economy to recover. So, unfortunately, every one of these issues are going to come back and be even more contentious throughout the summer and the fall. That means for agencies like NIH and NSF and DOE and NASA and others, what they have this year only applies to what they have this year. It doesn't give them any confidence to be able to plan on any stable kind of increase for 2012.
Jeffrey Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Jeffrey Mervis reports in this week's issue on the final U.S. spending bill for 2011 and what it means for science research and funding. There are many promises of biofuels, but the global experience so far has shown that many of those promises may be hard to keep, particularly in producing biofuels on the scale needed to meaningfully replace fossil fuels. For example, clearing land to plant biofuel crops may have a negative overall effect on greenhouse gas emissions, while using existing cropland for biofuel production raises concerns about food security. In a policy forum published online by Science, Elena Books and Joyce Tate argue for an ethical framework to address the complex problems of increased biofuel production, and they suggest steps that policymakers can take to establish a market in ethically produced biofuels. I spoke with Books from our office at the Nuffield Council on Bioethics in London.
It's pretty clear that it's essential to reduce our consumption of fossil fuels. But it would be very unrealistic to expect that, at least in the short term, we won't be needing transport fuels. And there are very few alternatives. And one such alternative is biofuels, fuels made from biomass. And when these first came around, they were regarded as a one-stop shop, a renewable, endless source of fuel that would also reduce greenhouse gases. Wonderful. And actually, many countries now have policies with targets that mandate the use of biofuels. And that has led to very rapid adoption. And that, in turn, has seriously backfired. So these policies have backfired in that lots of problems were linked to biofuel production. For example, deforestation or impacts on biodiversity and food price rises, some human rights issues. And it's also been discussed if they really deliver greenhouse gas emission savings. So we've looked at all of that in our report. And what we conclude are basically two things. One is we need to support better, newer biofuels technologies that avoid these issues, these problems. And secondly, that we need a set of ethical conditions, and we develop that set of ethical conditions in our report, that all production of biofuels must adhere to, and that should be implemented through a certification scheme.
So the idea then is to assume that these mandatory targets for biofuel production are not going away and that the global adoption of biofuels will continue, recognize these ethical issues and address them by changing policy to incorporate values.
Well, one thing we say is that these targets, we believe that they are important because targets are an incentive and they assure industry that there will be a market for biofuels. And this is an emerging field, and industry needs some assurance that somebody will buy these new technologies to invest in them. But what we say is that these targets need to be more responsive. So currently they're pretty blunt. For example, in the US, by 2022, you'll have to have 36 billion gallons of biofuels. Or in the EU, it's 10% of transport fuel from renewable sources by 2020, and that's that. And what we think is important is that these targets respond to some unintended consequences, and that, for example, the pace of scaling up can then be decreased.
Is there some precedent, some historical situation you and your co-author, Joyce Tate, have been considering that serves as a model or indeed a warning for the current issues with biofuel production?
Well, we haven't considered a specific historical example, but actually lots of technologies have been heralded as one-stop-shop solutions. And this is an example of an emerging technology that was regarded as the silver bullet, and indeed it isn't, and it has some unintended consequences. Pretty much most of today's emerging technologies have had that at some point. What's different with this one is that it's been very quickly implemented in policy, and thus adoption has been supported very much. That's a bit different. So we already have, despite the fact that biofuels haven't been around for such a long time, at least on a larger scale, we already have many countries that have targets and mandates in their policies, driving further expansion of biofuels.
Previously, you said that there were two things that were needed to address the issues and complexities of biofuel production: better technologies and supporting them, and these ethical conditions that you address with this policy form. What principles make up your and your co-author's ethical framework?
Well, we have developed five principles. They're pretty straightforward. One is that biofuels development should not be at the expense of people's essential human rights. Second one is that biofuels should be environmentally sustainable. The third, that biofuels should contribute to a net reduction of total greenhouse gas emissions and not exacerbate global climate change. Fourth, that biofuels should recognize the rights of people to just reward, and then that cost and benefits of biofuels should be distributed in an equitable way. And if we actually have technologies that satisfy these principles, we think that there is a duty to develop that, an ethical duty. You could call that our sixth principle, if you will, to develop such biofuels.
It seems like research is needed even before then any kind of implementation of these ethical principles is done, because there's still some disagreement about whether or not biofuels are better for the global greenhouse gas emissions.
Absolutely, yes. These principles sound straightforward, but what is needed in order to satisfy them is very complex indeed. And so we make some detailed recommendations that, for example, what we need is an international methodology to actually measure and calculate greenhouse gas emissions. And that's still very contentious. And we don't have an international accepted standard of environmental sustainability. So as it's often the case with ethical principles, these are, if you will, aspirational ideals. This is where we want to get to. This is what we want to tell policymakers, look, this is where you have to go. This is what you should aspire to. And there's a lot of research that needs to go into that. Meanwhile, some of the current policies need to implement some safeguards. And that's actually where the certification comes in. Because some things are very obvious. You know, when you have people working in near slavery conditions, that just can't happen. So what we think could help to get this off the ground with the situation that we actually have is using certification, mandatory certification, to try and avoid the problems that are currently going on.
Is there enough time to do this research, get agreement, and implement these safeguards before these mandatory targets need to be met?
Well, it is ambitious, but yes, it's important in any case. The targets are there. The policies are there. So what we think is needed is to implement some additional safeguards into these policies to try to make sure that the targets are met in a more sustainable, in a more ethical way. And this is a demanding task, but somebody once said, and it's a very overused metaphor, that biofuels sit at the eye of the perfect storm of having enough food for people, enough energy, enough water, whilst mitigating climate change and protecting the environment. So biofuels sit kind of in the crossfire of all of those problems. And it's a taster of what's to come. So it's a good idea to actually go and try to solve these problems now with biofuels, because other technologies in the future, other areas in the future in energy generation or in agriculture could benefit from this. So one further recommendation is that such an ethical framework is actually used in related technologies as well.
That was Elena Books, Assistant Director of the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, speaking there about the policy forum she co-authored on an ethical framework for biofuels. Find it online at scienceexpress.org. Over 100 years ago, the Wright brothers made their first flight. And looking at pictures of that first airplane, you would see a lot of differences between it and the planes we fly in today. But looking at pictures of the bicycles that the Wright brothers made, you would see that not much has changed. They employed the so-called safety design of bicycles with two wheels of equal size, a design that came to the United States from England around 1890. In part, it may be that not much has changed in bicycle design because a lot can go wrong. A little tweak here or there can change a bicycle from one in which you can ride fairly safely without even holding onto the handlebars to one that's nearly impossible to ride or steer, even when clutching the handlebars for dear life. Well, it turns out that over all those years, some of the mathematical descriptions for why a bicycle is more or less stable haven't been right. And in a paper in this week's Science, Andy Ruina and colleagues re-explore the mathematics of what allows a bicycle to be what's called self-stable, that is, to balance itself, moving along without a rider and, when it starts to fall over, correcting itself by turning so that the wheels are again under the frame. The researchers haven't yet figured out exactly why almost every bicycle does this, but have ruled out two previous explanations that had been thought to be right. I spoke with Ruina from his office at Cornell University.
Amazingly, people can ride bicycles, and even more amazingly, bicycles can balance themselves. And there have been two really popular explanations for how bicycles balance themselves. One is gyroscopic effects, and one is trail effects. And our discovery is that these explanations, even though they're over 100 years old, are both wrong, or at least incomplete. A bicycle can balance itself without either of those effects.
And what are gyroscopic and trail effects?
So the gyroscopic effect, something that has to do with the front wheel only, not the back wheel, and it's that the front wheel spinning is like a gyroscope, like a spinning top, like a spinning football. And spinning things have this funny mechanical behavior that if you try to turn them one way, they turn in a different direction. So on a bicycle, if the front wheel is spinning, which it does when you're moving along, and you lean the bicycle to the right, the gyroscopic torque then turns the wheel to the right. And this turning then steers the bicycle back under the person. So if you're falling to the right, leaning to the right, the bicycle steers to the right because of this gyroscopic torque, and that brings you back into balance, or at least helps bring you back into balance.
And the trail effect?
And it's also called the caster effect. This is something which is sort of hard to picture on a bicycle because the wheel is so big, and it's easier to picture, say, on the front wheel of a grocery cart. So a grocery cart has two bearings. One is the one that allows the wheel to turn, and another is like a pivot bearing, which you can think of as a steering bearing that allows the wheel to realign itself. So if you look at the front wheel of a grocery cart, or actually all four wheels in Europe, the wheel not only turns on its bearing like it rolls, but there's another bearing, a pivot bearing, that allows it to steer and change its direction. And that the wheel drags behind that pivot bearing is called caster. So the front wheel of a bicycle is also a kind of caster. It's hard to see it because the wheel is so big and the steering axis is so far away up near the handlebars. But if you extend a line right down the steering axis, which is called the head tube, it's a line that the whole front of the bicycle, the handlebars and so on, turn around when you steer. That line hits the ground a little bit forward of where the wheel touches the ground, just an inch or two. And so the wheel of a bicycle drags behind that steering axis, just like a grocery cart wheel drags behind the pivot axis. And that dragging behind, that positive distance between the wheel contact and the steering axis, is called trail or caster. So the caster effect is actually two different effects. One is this self-aligning that a grocery cart wheel does, that as you steer a grocery cart wheel around, the wheel automatically turns to follow the pivot. And to some extent, bicycle wheels do that or can do that. And a second caster effect is that if a bicycle is leaned, then relative to the bicycle frame, there's a sideways force on the front wheel where the ground touches it, and that can cause steering. And if everything works out right, that steering will be in the right direction to bring the bicycle, the moving bicycle, back underneath the rider. So in both cases, the caster effect and the gyro effect are from the bicycle steering in the direction of a fall.
So if you took a standard self-stable bicycle, how would you change its gyroscopic properties to make it unstable?
A standard bicycle is a kind of delicate thing. And if you did what David Jones famously did in his 1970 paper, you add a counter-spinning wheel, then that if it's spinning the backwards direction, it counters the gyroscopic effect. And if you take a standard bicycle and get rid of the gyroscopic effect, it will fall down. It won't be self-stable anymore.
And if you took a standard self-stable bicycle, how would you change its caster effect to make it unstable?
So that's easier to do. What you need to do is either bend the front forks or add a little piece of metal to where the wheel attaches to the front forks and move the wheel forwards relative to the forks so that the contact point is at the intersection of the steer axis with the ground or in front of it. So it's a funny thing about the geometry that most people haven't thought through is you look at the front of a bicycle and you see the forks are curved forwards and you think that sort of moves the wheel forwards, but it doesn't move the wheel forwards enough to make the ground contact point in front of the steering axis. On a conventional bicycle, the ground contact is still behind the steering axis. So you want to take that forwards bend of the fork and increase it either by bending the forks or by adding a piece of metal. And then if you do that, the bicycle, most bicycles, will then become unstable. And that's what David Jones wrote about in his 1970 paper.
Now, the title of your team's paper, A Bicycle Can Be Made Self-Stable Without the Gyroscopic or Caster Effects, you and your team then were able to create a bicycle without either a gyroscopic or caster effect and found it to be self-stable?
That's exactly correct. So it started with math, and then the equation said that you didn't need either the gyroscope or the trail effect. And then we built a bicycle that followed the equations, and it did follow the equations. So after it was built, you push it, and it balances itself, and you knock it sideways a little bit, and it would still balance itself.
What prompted you and your team to start down this mathematical road in the first place?
It was mostly the inspiration of Jim Papadopoulos, who was working with me at Cornell 25 years ago. And I guess he was inspired by that David Jones paper, where David Jones said trail was absolutely essential. And he just didn't find it credible. So we started this project of trying to figure out what it does take to make a bicycle stable. And the first big part of the project was trying to get decent equations for a bicycle. So that took about a year. And then the next was looking at those equations, trying to figure out how you could adjust parameters in the equations to make the simplest self-stable bicycle. And then Jim found that he could make a bicycle without gyroscopic or trail effects, and it was still self-stable.
Are there any unusual properties of this bicycle now that you've built it and seen what it can do?
Well, there's some unusual things about the way it looks, and there's some unusual things about the way it behaves. So in terms of appearance, you know, it doesn't look like a bicycle. It's a bicycle in that it rolls and it has two wheels, and it has a front frame and a rear frame that are hinged together, but it doesn't look like a conventional bicycle. It looks maybe more like a scooter. As far as how it behaves, it has a funny property, which is that bicycles can balance themselves if they're going fast enough, but not if they're going too fast. And the same is true for motorcycles. And this thing is different from all other known bicycles or motorcycles in that it doesn't lose its stability when it goes fast, like a motorcycle does or all known bicycles do. And that's kind of a theoretical result, because if a bicycle or motorcycle goes very fast, other effects come into play. But it does have this property that it doesn't lose its self-stability, at least according to the equations.
But you said, as it looks like a scooter, it probably wouldn't lend itself to a motorcycle design.
Well, I mean, the actual thing that we built isn't something that even looks like you could ride it. It's not even clear where you would put the seat. Same with bicycle or motorcycle. But we weren't trying to build the most user-friendly thing. We were trying to prove a point. So it was just built to sort of most quickly prove the point that you could make something self-stable without these effects. I think there are ways that you could sort of rearrange it so it could make a plausible motorcycle or a bicycle, but that's yet to be shown. We think that people have had a block in terms of what bicycles and motorcycles can look like, and this sort of frees up that block in terms of what they might look like. And I don't think we're thinking an ordinary bicycle going at ordinary speeds would end up much better because of these ideas, or even a motorcycle, but that you could make an entirely different bicycle that maybe you'd rearrange the vehicle to make it more comfortable or make room for baskets or make it so the person sits in a different place and so on. It just sort of opens up the design possibilities.
In this paper, you've identified two parameters that aren't needed, the gyroscopic or the caster effects for a self-stable bicycle. Have you identified any parameters that are universally needed for a bicycle's self-stability?
Well, yes and no. So the things which are needed are a little bit more abstract. So one thing that we know is needed is there has to be some mechanical effect that couples leaning to steering. So it has to be that somehow the mechanics has to be that when you force a bicycle to lean, that causes a bicycle to steer. And two effects which can do that are the gyroscopic effect and trail effect, but there are a few other effects that can also do that. And we can't say that any one of those is needed either, but you need to have, from the list of effects, you need to have some of them.
Andy Ruina, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Andy Ruina of Cornell University is corresponding author of a paper in this week's Science on how a riderless bicycle can be self-stable without gyroscopic or caster effects. Finally today, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about how distractions cause senior moments. I thought senior moments were just forgetting things, Dave.
Well, they are. Rob, if you've ever walked into a kitchen and wanted to get something out of the fridge, but then you get to the fridge and you forget what it was that you wanted in the first place, all of us have these quote-unquote senior moments, but as we get older, they get a lot more frequent. And scientists know that when you're distracted, you tend to have more senior moments. So if you were to walk into the kitchen knowing what you wanted, but then the phone rang, you're much more likely to forget what you wanted to get, say, in the fridge in the first place. And again, this is something that tends to happen as people grow older. What scientists didn't know is why distractions seem to contribute to these senior moments.
So is this a brain study then?
This is. The scientists took about 20 healthy adults, and they were in their 60s and 70s, and they had them play a simple memory game inside a brain scanner, and the scanner looked for activity in various parts of the brain. And the first game they had them play was very simple. They basically just showed these volunteers a series of pictures, like a picture of a field or a picture of a forest. And about 15 seconds later, they showed them a second image. And sometimes it was the same image they had seen before, and sometimes it wasn't. And they basically said, have you seen this image before? Very easy. And indeed, these volunteers got the right answer about 96% of the time. So they did very well. But in the second experiment, the researchers made things harder. They showed them that initial picture, but then they tried to distract the volunteers by showing them another picture, a picture of a face, and saying something like, can you tell me how old this person is or what the gender is? So they had the volunteers do a different task in the middle of trying to do their memory task. And this time around, the volunteers only got the correct answer about 88% of the time. So the distractions hurt their recall. It sort of gave them a bit of a senior moment.
And these were people in their 60s and 70s, so the control was a group of people who were younger?
Right. The control was a group of people that were in their 20s, and their performance did not drop significantly. So they did very well on the first easy experiment, and they also did very well on this harder experiment, which again goes to show that these senior moments and the distractions that cause them are more of a problem as you get older. So a lot of that stuff was what we knew before. But the next part of the study was the researchers trying to figure out, okay, what exactly is causing this? Why do distractions cause these senior moments? And they analyzed the data they got from these brain scans during those couple experiments. And what they found was that there was a lot of communication going on between the parahippocampal place area, which is a region of the brain that specializes in analyzing scenes, and the right middle frontal gyrus, which is a region of the prefrontal cortex that's thought to be involved in focusing attention on what's needed to accomplish a particular goal. And that was just the data from that first easy experiment. But what they saw in the second experiment, where the volunteers were interrupted with that task of trying to assign a face, an age, and a gender, was that the subject showed increased communication between the right middle frontal gyrus and the fusiform face area of the brain. And this is a region involved in analyzing faces. So all of a sudden, now you've got this other brain region coming into play.
So the right middle frontal gyrus, that was being used in both tasks.
Right. And so then the researchers drilled down and said, okay, well, we see all this going on, but there was clearly a difference in performance between the younger subjects and the older subjects. And what they found in the brain scans was what distinguished the older folks from the youngsters was that the older subjects were slower to switch off the face processing part of their brain and to reactivate the scene memory network of their brain. So in other words, when the young people, when the part of their brain was focused on remembering a scene and then they had to switch to the face task, they very quickly switched back to trying to remember the scene again when the experiment called for that. And the older people had a harder time switching between that. And the researchers think that delay could be one of the instigating factors for a senior moment.
So this was a timed task. They couldn't take as much time as they needed to decide, have I seen this before?
Right. And that's what's different from real life, because if you stand in front of that refrigerator for long enough, you're probably going to remember what you came there for. But this is really trying to measure what's happening at that time point that you have the senior moment.
So this brain scanning hadn't been done before. So how well does this interpretation of what's going on mesh with results of previous studies?
Well, Rob, the results actually mesh pretty well with what's been seen before. And even more interesting, they may help explain some other things that we don't call senior moments, but where distractions can play a really important and sometimes devastating role in our lives. You've heard of people getting into car accidents when they're talking on the cell phone, or even getting hit by a car when they're listening to music or somehow otherwise distracted crossing the street. And they're maybe a very similar thing going on here where our brains are trying to multitask various things at once. And especially the older we get, we're not as able to effectively multitask in our brain. And when we're switching between all these different things that we're supposed to be paying attention to, something gets dropped and we get into trouble.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from senior moments to smelling moments, this next story is about how birds' sense of smell may have helped them survive one of the most devastating extinctions in Earth's history.
Which extinction was that, Dave?
Well, Rob, this was the Cretaceous-Tertiary mass extinction, also known as the extinction that killed the dinosaurs and a bunch of other plant and animal life on Earth. And Very few creatures actually survived this, but we're pretty sure birds did. Birds are thought to have evolved from dinosaurs. Scientists have evidence that the ancestors of birds were around before this mass extinction event. The question has been, why did they survive when so many other animals died?
And their sense of smell helped?
That's what the study is arguing. What the researchers did was they looked at a lot of bird fossils, a lot of dinosaur fossils going back 150 million years ago, which is about 85 million years before this mass extinction, which happened about 65 million years ago. And looking at these fossils and doing various scans of them, they really focused in on the olfactory bulb. Now, this is a part of the nervous system that's involved with the sense of smell. And by looking at these olfactory bulbs over several different periods in history and looking at several different types of animals, they were able to calculate what they call an olfactory ratio. And basically, the higher the ratio, the better the sense of smell these animals had. And what they found is that the olfactory ratios of the earliest birds hovered about 20%. And this figure is about as high as their dinosaur ancestors had. So that's not too much of a surprise. But what was interesting is, as birds continued to evolve, right up until this point of this Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction, their olfactory ratios had risen to 30%, which is a lot higher than it was before. And then gradually over time, when we take it up to today, most birds have a less than 20% olfactory ratio. Now, what does all this mean? What it means is that the birds had actually evolved a very sophisticated sense of smell, or at least much more sophisticated than they have today, right before this extinction event. And the researchers think that actually helped them get through the extinction event, because with this very well-developed sense of smell, they were probably able to navigate very well. There's been some studies that show that the olfactory bulb is important in navigation. Also, some things like being able to hunt and find prey would have been a lot easier if these birds had a really good sense of smell. And that may have helped them through a period where there was probably a lot less prey to go around. It would have given them a competitive advantage over some of the other animals. Now, as time went on and we bring ourselves into the present, birds would have less of a reason to have a good sense of smell because they would have evolved a bunch of other attributes, perhaps better foraging abilities and better navigating abilities, where the sense of smell wouldn't have been as important. So if we just looked at birds today, we would say, well, they don't seem to have a very good sense of smell. But what we're missing, according to this study, is that they actually at some point in history had developed a very good sense of smell, and it came in at a very important time for these animals.
Are scientists proposing a similar explanation for why other animals made it through this extinction?
Well, not yet, Rob. Right now, researchers have just looked at birds and dinosaurs, but it's possible that the sense of smell could have helped a lot of other animals get through this extinction as well. But it's a lot easier, at least relatively easier, to study this in birds and dinosaurs because we have such an extensive fossil record to look back at with these creatures.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from birds and dinosaurs to ants, this last story is about how ant society resembles Facebook.
Not how Facebook resembles ant society?
Well, both of them could be true. Basically, this is about social networking in ants. And it's all about how ants communicate with one another. If you've ever seen an ant colony, you know there's sometimes thousands of these ants running around, but they all seem to be plugged into a sort of hive mind where they know what all the other ants are doing. There's ants going out to forage for food and look for predators. There's some ants that are in the nest that are perhaps interacting with the queen or doing other very important tasks. How do all of these ants keep it together? How do they all communicate with each other? And that's the focus of this new study, which looked at red harvester ants, which are native to the deserts of the American Southwest. And they live in large colonies of several thousand individuals. And what these ants do, which is what a lot of ants do, is they use chemical signals to send information. At first light, these patroller ants, these are ants that sort of go out and figure out what's going on in the environment, they emerge from the colony and they check out the surrounding area. They make sure it's free from predators and other natural hazards. And when they return, they signal to the forager ants that it's safe to go out and start gathering seeds for example, if there's no predators. So the way they communicate with each other is that they secrete these small molecules on their exoskeletons. These are chemical signals. And what happens is other ants will rub their antennae against the exoskeleton and they'll pick up these chemical cues. It's sort of like a hi, how are you? But beyond the hi, how are you, they're actually starting to pick up some cues about, you know, where these ants have been, maybe even what they saw, what they experienced. And this is how the information gets transferred. But it gets more complicated than that because That explains how the information gets transferred, but it doesn't explain how so many ants are able to coordinate all this information among themselves. And that's where the Facebook analogy comes in. Because as you know, on Facebook, there are some people that don't have very many friends, but there are other people that have hundreds or thousands of friends on Facebook. And they're what researchers call hubs because they are sort of this node of activity. They reach so many people with whatever information they post, they could be reaching thousands of people where, say, you or I might only reach a few hundred. And the ants are the same way. There are these select group of ants that just interact with so many other ants. And that actually helps propagate information a lot more quickly and a lot more efficiently than if all the ants were trying to communicate with each other.
Well, the fact that there's this analogy between how ants behave in terms of their numbers of social connections and how we behave, does that give any insight into the evolution of social networks or anything like that?
It does, because it's not just ants that live in these colonies and where tons of individuals are trying to interact with each other. A lot of other insects are very social insects as well. You can think about honeybees, for example. But there is a downside to this type of communication. Information travels very quickly in these social networks, but as you can imagine, disease could travel very quickly too, because if these node ants have a disease and they are touching all of these other ants, then that could spread very quickly, and that could obviously be a problem for the colony.
So to extend the analogy, like a person who's well connected on the internet maybe has a computer virus that spreads.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about a mollusk that has eyes made of rocks, and also a story about how humpback whales spread their songs eastward like the latest pop tune. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we are, as you talked about earlier on the show with Jeff Mervis, heavily covering the budget this week, what the impact of all of the wrangling that's going on in the U.S. government is going to have on scientific research and scientific agencies. We've also got a story about science in China, how the Chinese are becoming much more competitive in the scientific arena. And also this week, we are launching a brand new product called Science Live. This is a series of weekly chats on the hottest topic in science. This week's topic is about the future of space flight. We've got two experts on space exploration. We've got chats coming up about the Gulf oil spill 1 year later, and also a chat coming up about the ethics of animal research. These chats take place every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, so be sure to check all of this out on the site.
This was something that you did during the AAAS meeting back in February, is that right?
It is exactly right. We did a series of live chats there. Now they have become an institution. This is something we're going to do every week, and it's going to be very awesome.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, and join a live chat, Science Live, every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Find it all at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the April 15th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.